Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 123, I chat with Kevin Wines, the Imaging Technology Director at THX, about the future of video displays and delivery. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded August 6th, 2012, episode 123, What the Future Holds. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, online editor of hometheater.com. This week's guest geek is Kevin Wines, the Image Technology Director at THX. Hey, Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Scott. Pleasure to be back.
You were on a couple of years ago, so I figured it was easily time to come back and talk about all sorts of interesting things. I think you'll enjoy the show today, everybody. Those of you who are tuned into the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Kevin, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So I thought today we would talk about the future of television. Because obviously THX is very involved in the current state of the art, and I'm sure looking towards the future all the time, huh?
Yeah, we always keep an eye on what's coming, what's over the horizon. Fortunately, because we do spend some time in the consumer electronics world and in the post-production community, we get a chance to see things sometimes ahead of their release on the market.
Right, exactly. Well, a lot of people are talking today about 4K, and which means, well, one of two things, really. Either it means a greater resolution on your screen. Right now we have HD, which is 1920 across by 1080 down, or just over 2 million pixels. 4K is sometimes used to refer to quad HD, which is more technically the correct term for exactly four times that many pixels, twice in the vertical and twice in the horizontal. So that gives us, 3840 by 2160?
Right.
Am I got that right? Okay. Or it could mean 4096 by 2160. Either way, it's roughly on the order of 8.8 or 9 megapixels in the image. And so many people are asking about this for the home. And the question I want to start with you is, how important is it for the home?
Well, as screens get bigger, I think it is important. The average screen size now that people buy runs about 50 inches or bigger. Mm-hmm. So, but living rooms don't necessarily get larger, so you tend to sit closer to a larger screen. So you're going to begin to notice it. People really noticed the difference when we went from SD to HD, mm-hmm. and really saw a lot of detail, especially when production started moving into full HD production and broadcast. And so they'll notice it again. The detail difference is pretty striking.
I have to say, I agree. When I've seen 4K, even on a smaller screen, but like at a trade show, when you see it on a smaller screen, you can also go right up to the screen, almost put your nose on the screen. And so I wonder, though, if in a 50-inch or even a 60-inch display, if you are, 8, 10, 12, 15 feet back, as many people are, which is too far even for HD, will they even see a difference with 4K?
The short answer is yes. There's some detail that goes behind that, and actually it's detail about detail. because even at those distances, you know, obviously it's always about your field of view. I mean, humans see a certain amount of detail in an arc minute of their field of view. But within that, you still, you'll notice the finer detail. You'll see one of the most striking things to me always is when you look at different resolutions and different ways of transmitting is human skin. It's one of those things that's just burned into our memory from the time we're babies looking up at our mother. Mm-hmm. We know when it looks right, and we know when it doesn't. And so when you start to see that, even that extra little bit of tiny detail, it, you just, without even thinking about it consciously, your mind says, this is realistic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, that's one.
Go ahead. I was going to say, it's almost a subliminal or a subconscious thing. Much like as we hear human voice, and no matter how well a human voice is synthesized, you can almost always tell that it's synthesized.
Well, and you listen to modern music, you can always tell when they're going through a harmonizer.
Right. Exactly.
Every time.
Yep. You were about to make another point about.
That's just one example, but it's really, it goes even deeper than that. Anything that's really. I mean, you hear a lot of people talk about memory colors, but memory objects. We know instinctively what plants look like. And if you've got a camera shot of a landscape and the little tiny details of the leaves are there, you notice it, and you notice it right away.
Mm-hmm. Sherlock Holmes in the chat room is asking, how long before we have those TV-walled rooms like they had in Fahrenheit 451?
Well, some of the manufacturers are already getting up into the 108-inch screens. I mean, truth be told, it's not going to be long if you really want it.
Yeah, it's true. Did you go to, I think it was CES last year, not this past year, but the year before. I don't remember exactly. Sharp had basically a video room in which they tiled the walls and the ceiling and the floor. You couldn't step into it, but you could look into it. Entirely with TV panels, and you could show this huge, incredible panorama. Did you see that at that show?
I did see that.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. And then I think it was Cedia, I want to say last year as well, where Panasonic had the giant plasma panel.
Yeah, the 152-inch.
Yeah. And, of course, truth be told, you could do it with projection now. A lot of the new home theater projectors are pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Even if we do get 4K displays in the home and the benefits of them, certainly as we've just talked about, are increased detail, even in the tiniest, almost subliminal elements, how is 4K material going to get delivered to the home? I mean, Blu-ray can't really do it unless it's adapted in some way. Online, I have a hard time believing, you know, people have enough bandwidth to get 4K.
Well, there's a couple of answers to that. Actually, Blu-ray, if you look at the spec, it's a part of the spec they actually never bump into yet. It can go up to 40 megabits a second. They can do multi-layer. So conceivably, you could put a movie in 4K on the disc. Obviously compressed like they do now. Same thing with any sort of online or over-the-top delivery. As life continues each day, you know, bandwidth capabilities get better. It's easier now to get, you know, higher bandwidth broadband in your home. I enjoyed doing that myself recently. Mm-hmm. And the point, truth be told, there's a lot of work going on what they call high-efficiency codecs, where they can get high spatial resolution compressed down to data rates that are really pretty surprising in maintaining a good picture quality. My phone's ringing.
I hope you can ignore it.
I can ignore it. I hope you can.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, good. Thank you. I've actually seen a demonstration of 4K originated material running at data rates that will fit in broadcast.
That's 19.2 megabits per second.
Yeah, and this was not pushed that hard. And I saw it on a 55-inch panel, and I thought it looked really pretty darn good.
Huh? That was a 4K 55-inch panel, right?
It was a 4K 55-inch panel. It was the data at 4K, and it was remarkably good. Is it ready for prime time? Maybe. do I have absolute faith that they'll get it there? Yes. I think they'll be able to do it.
Big Nut Squirrel in the chat room is saying Kansas City people could probably stream 4K. You heard about that, right? They've got they now have 100, or is it a gigabit per second bandwidth available in Kansas City?
Yeah, via fiber. And to that point, by the way, I was born and raised in Kansas City. So,
kidding.
Good innovation there.
Absolutely.
And see, that's really what it takes is they, you know, start building out infrastructure kind of for the next generation of data connectivity. Why wouldn't you be able to push 4K through it?
You know, I've been a skeptic about that, but then when I heard about this Kansas City thing and Verizon Fios, I think routinely can give you 100 megabits anyway. You know, maybe it's not so far off after all.
I would say it's not. I would agree with
you. What about, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I agree with you. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay, great. I was going to ask about, I know mostly we're talking about the home here, but I do want to mention 4K in commercial cinemas. You and I talked about this offline a bit, and there are theaters now with 4K projectors. Sony in particular, Christie and Barco are now starting to come out with 4K DLP projectors. But do we really see 4K content when we go to a theater that has a 4K projector, or is it 2K upscaled?
It's been quite a while. It's been 4 years at least, possibly five, that a number of the movies released are released as 4K packages.
And I was unaware of that.
Well, and actually beyond that, almost all the Hollywood studios, at least, are now, at least they're really A titles. They're actually finishing and archiving in 4K, even if some of them still get released in 2K.
I knew that they were archiving almost everything in 4K now, but in terms of actually getting 4K content to the theater, I thought that was still rare, but perhaps I'm wrong.
No, any place, actually, a lot of the now bear in mind, we're talking 2D here.
Yes, correct.
Right. But they've been doing what they call the layered compression on the digital cinema packages for a number of years. Interestingly enough, from a data standpoint, the extra spatial information to go from a 2K image to a 4K image is only 8, maybe 10%.
Really?
From a data standpoint. So the packages don't actually get significantly bigger.
Is that because of the improved compression that they're using on 4K?
Actually, no. It's just the fact that even though we notice it, we see it, 4K is a drastic change to what we as humans perceive. When you take all of the visual information that's in a 2K image, and then you add on top of that, remember, all you're adding on top of that is the tiny fine detail that is then part of the 4K image. It's actually... From a data capture standpoint, it's a remarkably small amount of the data.
So I hadn't thought of it that way. Yeah,
so it's really true. I mean, if you think about, if you really back up and you say, okay, I have to transmit, 320 by 180, and then start layering on top of it to say, get it to 720, it's actually not that much more information to get it there. I was going to finish up real quick. The way they create them is in this layered fashion so that it's a single inventory. And so as you load it into a system that's designed for 2K, it just pulls the 2K layer. If you load it into a system like the Sony system that is designed to play back 4K, it can play back the entire 4K image. And so in those theaters, when it's a 2D movie, there's a really good chance you are seeing a 4K movie.
Wow. Well, that's very interesting. It kind of reminds me of DTS HD, which is the new high resolution lossless audio codec, which if your equipment can't handle that, it automatically downshifts to what's called the DTS core, which is lossy. That is, you lose some information, but it requires a lot less bandwidth. So this sounds very similar to that, kind of a layered approach.
It definitely is.
Mm-hmm. Curtis B. in the chat room is asking, what compression method did they use for that 4K broadcast demo you saw?
It was a version of H.264.
Wow. Now, in movies, maybe you know something about this, and I've always wondered. Movies are often compressed using a codec called JPEG 2000, right. Whereas in the home, it's H.264 or MPEG-4. Why the difference?
I'm not sure why they centered on H.264 for the home. JPEG 2000, there was a lot of reasons why they picked it. Part of it is the core. A lot of the core code on it was public domain. And so they felt that one of the reasons, along with all of the qualitative tests that they did to prove out that it would work for Hollywood movies on a large screen.
Right.
Part of their motivation was to choose something that wouldn't at all be burdened necessarily with patents and copyrights that could infringe on any manufacturer from being able to produce it and to support digital cinema.
Right, right. Licensing and all that stuff.
Yeah, and the other interesting sort of side note to that is they both are wavelet-based. So they both compress the data in, we'll say, similar fashions. And when you get to the point that you can begin to actually perceive visually the compression on top of the image, they look very similar.
Huh. Can you explain what wavelet-based means in somewhat reasonable terms, not super geeky, super math? I mean, I know we're home theater geeks here, but that could get into some serious math.
Well, you get into, you if you back up and you look at MPEG 2, mm-hmm. that's called DCT or discrete cosine transform. And it's actually looking at small block sizes, little pixel blocks, whether they're 4x4, 8x8, 16x16. Okay. And it's looking at the amount of data that can be thrown away based on what's inside that particular pixel block.
In terms of what's inside there, in terms of redundancy.
Redundancy, exactly. And in a wavelet form, one of the things it does is it doesn't break it into small blocks like that. It's actually analyzing the entire image at the same time.
Mm.
The other thing that's different actually at a higher level from a less detailed level is H.264 and JPEG 2000 are what they call all iframe. In other words, every frame that you see is a complete frame of information, whereas the way the MPEG that you watch is, it's called group of pictures. So some of the frames, you know, a redundant information from one frame to the next doesn't get transmitted. So the things called P frames and B frames actually derive their information from the what's called the I frames or the complete frames that are at either end of this group of pictures. They're usually 12 or 15 frames.
I see.
So that allows the MPEG type compression to be efficient. The problem is if any of that data gets even slightly corrupt, you lose a whole picture. You lose a whole frame. Whereas in the two versions of wavelet, and it's really not dependent on the wavelet compression, it's just the way they choose to do it, absolutely every frame is a complete image.
So there isn't any reconstruction that has to happen?
No reconstruction, no motion estimation, no motion compensation. So it doesn't try to track objects or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Sherlock Holmes in the chat room has a great question here. Is there a top-out point on resolution, or will it be an ever-increasing thing? I mean, certainly with human vision, there is a point beyond which you can't see anything more. And that depends on the size of the image as well as how far you are from it.
Right. Well, I can't imagine. I mean, you would think there's going to be some point where you sort of hit a point, you hit the diminishing returns point.
Right.
At the same time, there are several locations currently where NHK is broadcasting the Olympics in 8K.
Right. Otherwise known as UHD or Ultra HD.
Right. By the way, 4K is part of that spec as well, the UHD TV.
Oh, it is?
Spec. Yeah, it's 4K and 8K.
Wow. So they're actually broadcasting the Olympics in 8K.
Mm-hmm. To you know, specific large public demonstrations of it.
Sure. Sure.
And, you know, is 8K enough?
Good question.
Probably. Probably. Maybe.
Probably. I got a question back here. Let's see. I'm trying to find it. It was about 2K on a really big screen. Here it is, Metro Scenes. 2K seems like it would look really bad on a full-size movie screen, but it doesn't.
That's true. And that's because there's a lot more than spatial resolution at play there.
Exactly. And that's where, in fact, I wanted to go next, which is temporal resolution. But finish the thought. Before we get into that specifically, tell us about why 2K looks reasonable on a huge screen. And I've seen plenty of 2K on a big screen like that, and I can't see the pixels at the right seating distance.
At the right seating distance. I have a bad habit. I'll always put myself at the seating distance where I can see pixels. people asking me to analyze things like compression always get upset and try to get me further away from the screen.
Right.
But there's even more to it than that. The interesting thing is I could show you a 4K image side by side with a 2K image, and if the dynamic range or contrast ratio of that 4K image is lower than the 2K image, you are likely to tell me that the 2K image looks more real and natural.
Wow.
And in fact, bear in mind, we humans who evolved, you know, with a lot of our body's evolution comes from survival in the wild.
Sure.
Because we were in the wild much longer than we have been in civilization.
Yep.
The dynamic range of our eyes is at its maximum roughly 1,000,000 to 1 in about 10,000 to 1 increments.
Right. Right. You can't see 1,000,000 to 1 all at the same time. That 10,000 to 1 range moves up and down depending upon how much ambient light we are in the middle of.
Right. And the other part of it, which is related, is a lot of your audience already knows this. We are most sensitive in the green yellow band of color.
Right.
Okay. Why is that? We needed to see tigers hiding in the bushes, in the shadows, so that we could know to run away from them. Right? So our eyes are evolved.
Bushes are green and the tigers are yellow or orange.
Exactly. And so we're evolved to see very, 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 very subtle differences in shading and grayscale levels, much more so than we are to seeing fine detail. And so if I give you a high dynamic range picture that accurately depicts all of the details in the shadows and all the details in the highlights without clipping, I can give you a lower resolution picture of it, but you'll know that you're seeing more detail than if I give you a high resolution of one that's compressed dynamic range.
Hmm. Wow, so I hadn't thought of that, but that's a good point.
One of the reasons the DLP cinema projectors look so good to us at 2K is because one of the things they had to do before Hollywood would put movies out on their systems was they had to get the dynamic range to a point where you would get comments like that. Hey, 2K looks pretty darn good.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, that's something to keep in mind, certainly. It's hard to tell, speaking of 2K versus 4K, when you go into a theater, what you're getting. I mean, because the 2K looks so good.
Yeah. Well, you could always do what I do, is I walk down to the first two or three rows and kind of look at what the thing looks like on the screen.
I can't watch a whole movie from the first two or three rows, though.
No. But I sometimes, if I'm not sure what kind of projector they have, if I can't tell by looking back into the port, I just go down take a quick look. And you can, once you get close enough to see pixels, you can tell.
Yeah, true enough. Well, I mentioned a moment ago that I also wanted to talk about temporal resolution. We've been talking about spatial resolution, which is the number of pixels on the screen. But there's also temporal resolution, and that really refers to frame rates. And we've talked a lot on this show, and we've heard a lot in the industry about higher frame rates. Films are almost universally filmed, shot at 24 frames per second. And James Cameron and Peter Jackson are now talking about their next projects are going to be shot at higher frame rates. The Hobbit at 48 frames per second. Avatar 2 apparently at 60 frames per second.
Right.
What advantage does this give us? Even perhaps more important than spatial resolution, higher pixel density.
Well, I won't get into the politics of which one is more important.
All right.
But I will say that, you know, in any case, when more specific and more precise information is delivered to your eye, you're going to get the experience is going to be that of realizing that it looks more real, more realistic. Mm-hmm. And the temporal resolution is right there in the middle of it because, you know, obviously if you've ever looked at a still frame of something shot at 24 frames a second, during that window of time while that frame's being captured, which is 30-ish milliseconds, I think.
Yeah, it's not exactly 1/24th of a second because the shutter is only open for a portion of that time.
Good point. So even more so. So that small window of time, well, actually, if something's in motion, a little window of time that the shutter is open to capture one frame is mm-hmm. actually a very large window of time relative to the motion of an object.
Yes.
So what happens is...
So it looks blurry.
Well, that's we lovingly call that motion blur, and we've grown accustomed to it. We go watch a movie at 24 frames a second. You're very likely to notice if the motion blur isn't there. It actually what looks really bizarre to people is if you can go back and find early animation, you know, really never not filmed in any way, shape, or form. Say computer generated animation. Where they hadn't learned to add motion blur yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks very still, like it's very stilted and like it's got a stutter, even though it is 24 frames a second recorded and 24 frames a second played back. And that's because we expect, unconsciously, we expect that motion blur to be there. And it looks more natural to us when your temporal rate is slow. Well, relatively speaking, slow at 24 yeah. frames a second, right?
Right.
And in fact, some people insist that that's part of the artistry of using those frame rates. And yeah, you can use blur as an artistic tool.
Sure. Why not?
Sure. But let's say a panel van with writing on it drives by the camera. You'll never read it.
Right.
But at,
right. And,
even
and maybe you want to, maybe the director wants you to be able to read it. Maybe that's part of the story.
Right. So the way they handle it now is they have to slow it way down so you can.
Mm-hmm.
Or even do a setup shot where it's not in motion.
Right. Right. Right? Exactly. And then maybe it starts driving away after you've had a chance to read the sign.
Yeah.
Something the other along one, those lines.
Anybody who's played with photography at all, still photography at all, shoot a waterfall. Shoot it at a high shutter speed and shoot it at a low shutter speed.
Yep.
You'll see the water drops at the high shutter speed. You'll see these really beautiful artistic streaks at the low shutter speed, and they both have their value.
Right, exactly right.
But if your goal is to show the world something that is extremely realistic, then you need that high temporal resolution to do it.
And I know that you and I have both seen the demonstration that Jim Cameron did for Christie. Right. In which he shot a number of scenes of a medieval banquet and a fight scene and a couple other things with yep. lots of detail and lots of really hard stuff for 24 frames per second. It would look very blurry at 24, which he shot at 24 and 48 and 60 and just played them one right after the other. And the difference is incredible.
It absolutely is. Especially, and again, we talked about this offline a little bit, the detail. When the camera's panning, if one of the people dressed as a knight is wearing, you know, the fine woven chainmail, it just looks like a gray cloth almost at the slow shutter speeds. High shutter speeds, you actually, as the camera pans, you see that detail. You see that he's wearing chainmail. Right. You can even, if you look closely, you can even see where it's been dented and damaged a little bit up near your shoulder.
Right. Right.
And then the sword fight that they showed where they're in a couple inches of water on the floor while they're fighting.
Right.
And the water splashes were just so telling. Or even the expressions on their faces as they're in motion.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually see what they're doing with their faces at the higher frame rates. It's just a flesh tone blur at 24 frames a second.
Right. But as you said earlier about spatial resolution, the ability to see greater detail in skin tones and skin texture really does a lot to improve the sense that we're looking through a window at an actual scene.
Right.
That reality.
Absolutely true. Yeah, like it's more real.
Right. Now, I've heard some people who have seen that demo actually complain that higher frame rates, like 48 and 60, are, they call it hyper real, that it almost looks too real. And okay, well, that's their opinion. That's fine. I personally really like it myself.
Yeah. Well, and again, as you said, that's their opinion. And I would put those kind of statements in the category of opinion. And therefore perfectly valid.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, personal preference. I like seeing the higher frame rates. But I also won't deny that I also like seeing a good transfer properly done of an old silver nitrate black and white film,
mm-hmm.
which you can't reproduce digitally right now. That kind of dynamic range. To me, it all depends on the context. If it's a lot of close-ups and three-quarter shots and it's a character study and it's shot in a couple of rooms of a house, is high frame rate or even 3D going to help? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
If it's an action film, I'm all for things like high frame rate.
Very good. Excellent point. That's exactly right. Because the action film has got a lot of fast motion in it. You want to see that detail. I do anyway.
Well, and you don't want to be annoyed by the fact that it's so blurry you really can't tell what's going on. I mean, let's put it into context here.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're exactly right. Context is everything.
So to me, it's like back in the day when we were sort of having the public arguments about, you know, to go digital cinema or not, mm-hmm. Or to go digital cinematography or not. To me, it's not an either or. It's just another thing on the creative palette.
It's a very good point. It's a very good point because there are people, filmmakers certainly, who still prefer to shoot on film and others who are totally into digital. I wonder if there are any, I can't think of any, who do both depending on the film they're making.
Nothing comes to mind right away, but that wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, there must be somebody out there doing that.
Yeah, they would make the choice based entirely on the film that they are considering at the moment.
Right, exactly. Before we leave this subject, I just wanted to mention that there have been experiments in the past with higher frame rates. Douglas Trumbull did something called ShowScan, which I think was at 60 frames per second.
Yes.
And he also used, I think, 70 millimeter film. At that time, there wasn't any digital cinematography. And he used a large format film. And I saw a couple of demos of that and was very impressed.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned something to me. Todd A.O. had done some work on this.
Well, yeah, to the point that it got into cinemas. Todd, back in the mid to late 50s, Todd
really?
A.O., which now we know, you know, here in Hollywood is a great, you know, sound facility.
Sure.
Actually, they partnered with an old film projector company called Norelco.
Mm-hmm.
And they did shots in 30 frames a second, which, believe it or not, 24 to 30 frames a second visually is a significant difference.
You wouldn't think so, and yet it is, huh?
Yeah, it really makes quite a difference. And so there were actually some movie titles that went out in 30 frames a second. Of course, you know, it's all about economics at that point. That's, what is that? Six more frames a second. So you're looking at what, 25% more film?
More film. Yeah, exactly. Which is why 24 was chosen in the first place, is in order to conserve as much film as possible while still maintaining at least some semblance of smooth motion.
Right. And then they discovered that when they could double flash it, you know, it got past our perception of seeing the flicker.
Right.
So that's how all that evolved. But yeah, there were a lot of film projectors out there where there was a double pulley system on the back, and you could just move the belt, drive belt, from 24 to 30 frames a second.
Hmm. Well, the last question in this regard is, when do you think we'll see high frame rates delivered to the home? Once again, I want to try to bring it back to the home. And, you know, 4K, okay, we probably have the bandwidth to do that sooner than later online. Probably also higher frame rates, don't you think?
My television's 1080p.
Well, and 120 hertz.
Well, right. Therefore, it is able to accept 60 frames a second progressive. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing in the home technology to prevent it. It's really a matter of, you know, going upstream. Is the delivery mechanism capable of it? Well, I know that a lot of the new, you know, the newer set-top boxes work at 1080 60p mm-hmm. as a top level. So the only thing we're waiting on at this point from the home is content.
Content. You think the studios will be delivering anything at higher frame rates anytime soon?
Well, starting November, they're going to do it in the cinemas. So, you know, there's sort of a line of demarcation to see what they do from that point forward to mm-hmm. once that becomes a... you know, a home video release, are they going to look at the methods of delivering it at the higher frame rate? I honestly don't know. I sincerely hope so.
Yeah. Can Blu-ray handle higher frame rates? I think it can.
It's all about data rate. So if you don't, you know, if you're not banging into the top data rate, it should be able to. Of course,
you know,
the current versions of the hardware don't.
Right.
The ones that can be software upgraded, you know, firmware upgraded, probably stand a better chance of making that transition more quickly.
Right. Well, before we move on, I do want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Netflix. And of course, Netflix will be at the forefront of all of this as it develops. We're talking about the future of TV. But for right now, you can stream thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to your television or your computer or your smartphone or your tablet, any display device you have, using just about any consumer electronics device you have, because the Netflix app is available on just about all of them. You can even start on one device and finish on another at your leisure, and you can stream as much content as you can possibly consume for one low monthly subscription. So if you want to check it out, those few of you who are listening to and watching this show who don't already have it, please go to netflix.com/twit for a free 30-day trial to check it out for yourself. Please use that URL, netflix.com/twit, for your free 30-day trial. And we thank Netflix very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire Twit network. So, Kevin, the next topic that I really want to talk about here is 3D. We've talked about spatial resolution. We've talked about temporal resolution. And now, of course, 3D, which has been with us in its modern incarnation for a couple of years now, 2 or 3 years at least. And from everything from all the consumers I talk to and correspond with, there's quite a divide in between the people who like it and the people who don't. So I wonder, the big question, of course, that always is asked is it here to stay this time? We've seen 3D come and go several times in the 50s, a little bit in the 70s, and here it is again in the 20-teens. Is it here to stay this time, do you think?
Well, I think what's going to help answer that question moving forward in our conversation, I'll take a step back a moment. I think because, well, high frame rate. High frame rate, because of the way the digital version of 3D is implemented, some of the things that makes it, shall we say, occasionally unpleasant to watch.
Yes.
Has to do with the fact that fast motion is difficult for the 3D for a number of reasons, not the least of which is all of it is produced with your left eye and your right eye captured or created at the same moment in time. But when we watch it on our modern televisions and in the theaters, in most cases, they're shown first one eye, then the other. So there is a slight temporal offset between the left eye and the right eye being delivered to you.
Ah, that's interesting. It reminds me a little bit of interlacing. On the TVs that do interlacing, you see a frame that was captured at all at once, in some cases, many cases, but then it's presented to you in two chunks, one after the other, and that can cause some problems.
Correct. Kind of like that. This has to do with the fact that, say, in a theater, you've got a single lens and a single imager. In a television, you've got a single pixel array. Mm-hmm. So, say with active shutter glasses or with the, virtually all of the implementations of 3D in cinemas, with one exception, you're dealing with the fact that it's the same imager showing you both left eye and right eye. So right. they have to offset them temporarily by just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And to exacerbate it a little bit, they have to put a little bit of black in between them. So,
which impacts the brightness and the contrast ratio, as you were talking about earlier, how important contrast ratio is.
Correct.
And also fact that the glasses also reduce the light in the light that actually reaches your eye.
Right. So all of those things that have made it, made a number of consumers say they don't like it, actually get mitigated when high frame rate comes.
Mm-hmm.
And also get mitigated as they get much better at producing things, the auto stereoscopic devices, where you don't need glasses.
Mm.
Because then you overcome that problem with the, glasses are cumbersome. I've got to keep my active glasses charged. Oh, God, yeah. Somebody sat on my pair of glasses. They're not compatible with my neighbor. Yeah, right? They're not compatible with my neighbor's TV. All of these things. That make it kind of a pain in the neck.
Right.
So if all that gets mitigated, and then on top of it, there's a lot of action movies out there that were done in 3D. Where the action is just a little bit too fast for that temporal offset, and you notice it. You may not be able to consciously put words on it, but you notice that you've got this discomfort because the left and right eye aren't exactly matched.
That's a very good point, yeah.
So high frame rate helps that go away, and the demonstration you mentioned for Jim Cameron was 3D. It wasn't
That's
just
true.
2D.
Right. That's exactly right. Now, when you're looking at 3D, you actually have to cut the frame rate in half per eye, right? I mean, if you're being presented at 60, or maybe that's not true. Correct me if I'm wrong. If you're at 60 frames per second, is that 60 frames per eye?
It sure is. That's why 120 hertz refresh is a minimum requirement.
Ah, of course.
Right.
Now, I know LCDs can do that.
Well, LCDs can do it. Actually, DLPs can do it. Some plasmas can certainly do it.
Mm-hmm.
But that gets into, you get into, the multiple flashing again. Because if you go back to the 24 frames a second stuff you watch in a cinema now,
mm-hmm.
it's actually flashed at 72 hertz per eye.
True. It's what's called triple flashed. Each frame is flashed on the screen three times.
Right. But as you increase your frame rate, you don't need that multiple flashing. So at 60 frames a second, you can do one flash per eye, which means you eliminate a fair amount of that black space in between.
Oh, that's a good point.
And your temporal offset's a little bit closer, enough so that higher action is less of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so those kinds of things will help make 3D more attractive because it becomes a more pleasant experience. It doesn't create that physical discomfort as much.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get into some of the developments that are out there with some of the auto stereo stuff that's actually becoming quite good, some of it may be ready for market sooner than others, where you don't have to worry about glasses and you don't have to worry about brightness anymore. I think it's going to stick around. To me, it's another tool on the palette.
Mm-hmm.
Or another creative tool. Is it interesting for the Avengers movie? Absolutely. Is it interesting for something like the TV show Political Animals, where it's all about the people and, you know, their interactions?
Right.
I don't need that. I don't need something like that in 3D.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. Well, speaking of auto stereo displays, what have you seen that really looked good to you? For me, the best I've seen so far is from Dolby. They have an auto stereo flat panel technology they've worked on with Philips for a while, and I saw it at NAB for the first time, and I was quite impressed.
Same one. That clearly shows that there's a direction that auto stereo can go and really be something viable for the market.
Yeah. There was much less weirdness as you moved from one viewing area to the next. You didn't have to keep your head clamped in a vice.
Right. Well, part of the reason of that is they significantly increase the number of views available.
Mm. So lessening the transition between them because there are so many of them.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Have you been watching the Olympics in 3D?
Some of it.
Some of it?
Because they put it at such an inconvenient time of day. So, to your point, when we were offline, I DVR it. And have been watching it.
What's your impression?
It comes and goes. part of it is because they're using the cameras that have the fixed interocular or interaxial distance.
Yeah.
Big, wide, broad, or long shots don't always work as well as hoped. But that's kind of a common situation with, you know, 3D.
It's a common problem. Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing, you can't sit here and say they completely fouled it up because they didn't. There's a lot of the footage that's really good to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it sort of depends on the event, whether or not it's significant to me. I found things, some of the events where it's, field events, I found it to be a bit less interesting to me than, say, gymnastics.
Mm-hmm.
Or even tennis. But, tennis, the BBC beat them. Wimbledon was shot in 3D just a few weeks ago.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So Wimbledon was done in 3D as well.
Mm.
Some activities really lend themselves to 3D more than others.
The one that really got me, that really impressed me, was the canoeing. They have this sort of fake rapids, artificial rapids river, and they have some shots up the rapids, and you can see them receding in the distance. I thought that was a very effective shot.
Yes. Yes, it was. That is a good example of where it works well.
Yeah. However, I have been noticing a fair amount of ghosting. I don't know if you've seen the same thing. The NBC bug up in the upper right-hand corner it always looks very ghosty to me. And very often white highlights, like lights, stadium lights and white pieces of uniform and so on. The signage around the stadium often has a lot of crosstalk and ghosting in the Sony projector that I'm using. You're using a plasma, an LG plasma, right?
Correct. Yeah.
And have you noticed that?
Well, a tiny bit, but ghosting in general, you're going to see ghosting the most when you are at your highest luminance level. So stadium lights, they're likely to ghost on just about any display you watch.
Mm-hmm.
The Bug, as an example, you might see that for a couple of reasons. One is it's put there and just stuck at a very specific plane. And sometimes, in fact, if I were going to complain at all, the fact that objects that I'm trying to focus on are moving in and out and around that bug and sometimes through it, and that's can be a little distracting.
Right.
But bearing in mind, the bug is all, 100% saturated, primary, or, well, actually primary and secondary colors.
And secondary colors, yeah.
So, it, again, everything is at or near full luminance on that bug, so it is like most likely to be an object that's going to ghost on you.
Well, there you go. Maybe then it's not as much to do with the feed as it is to do with just these elements that really you can't control. High brightness, full saturation, so on, are just going to be more ghosty.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of the sort of the nature of the beast.
Mm-hmm. I'm hoping to get, before the Olympics are over, I'm hoping to get an LCD, 3D LCD with passive glasses into my home theater and check that out, because NBC is broadcasting the Olympics in 3D in what's called side by side, right? So
right.
The horizontal resolution is cut in half per eye. Then with a passive 3D TV, the vertical resolution is cut in half per eye, because the odd numbered lines are, say, the right eye and the even numbered lines are the left eye, or vice versa. I don't remember which it is, but in any event, when you're looking at a flat panel with passive 3D glasses, that's what you're going to see. So ultimately, you're only getting a quarter resolution per eye. I'm curious to see how that works. I haven't tested it yet, but it's going to be something I'm going to try and do.
I do recommend it. If you haven't looked at some of these with the passive glasses, this would be a good test. Side-by-side stuff is an excellent test for it. You'll be surprised, though.
You think I'll see I'll have a greater sense of detail than I think I should with that kind of resolution?
And you'll see significantly less ghosting.
Well, that gives me more motivation still to go up to our studio and grab one of those sets and bring it down to my house. Because the only place I have a 3D broadcast source is my house right now, DirecTV, which I got installed specifically so I could watch the Olympics in 3D, because I really wanted to see it. People have been touting this as 3D at home, or 3D broadcasting's avatar moment. That this was what was going to launch broadcast 3D into the limelight the same way that Avatar did for movies.
Right.
And I don't know if that's true yet or not, but I'm certainly having fun watching it.
It's great stuff. I'm enjoying it myself.
Yeah, exactly. The next topic that I wanted to touch on with you is online distribution. We talked about that a little bit earlier in terms of bandwidth for getting 4K into the home. My question to you and to most of my guests when we get to this topic is, do you think online distribution will ultimately replace physical media? Is Blu-ray the last optical disc we're likely to see, or will optical physical media of some sort remain viable, at least in a niche kind of market, similar to LP?
Yeah. Again, that's a tough question. You're always it may be a niche, but you're always going to have, there's these percentages of the population. One is somebody who likes to have that solid physical object in their hand always.
Yep.
It's just a little bit too difficult to get your mind around the fact that movie's out there somewhere, and you don't really know, you can't put your fingers and your hands on where that thing is in space.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes said that humans are collectors by nature, and having a physical thing to collect appeals to some deep part of who we are.
Absolutely. I think that's a very good point to make on this subject. The other one is, and this gets back to when bandwidth becomes, high bandwidth becomes ubiquitous and ridiculously cheap.
Yeah.
That you can then get something streamed to you online at the quality level you can from an optical disc.
Yes.
There's going to be a group of people who, you know, take that mindset about it as well. It's hard to imagine. I mean, you know, truthfully, I wouldn't have expected CDs to fall as much as they have with online audio, but they have.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still out there.
That's true. They're not dead completely, but their sales have fallen dramatically. People seem to have chosen convenience over quality. You know, they're listening to MP3s, which are not as high quality as even CDs. Audiophiles think CDs aren't all that great either. But on the other hand, you can download 2496 audio from online and store it on a hard disk and, you know, play it that way and get the high quality as well as the convenience of not having a physical thing for those who don't care about having a physical thing.
Right. Well, and I think that's it. Although, again, you know, if you better have several terabytes handy if you are a serious music collector and you want to download it uncompressed.
Yes, exactly right.
And, you know, the movies are the same way. I mean, if you've ever watched a play out of absolutely pristine DPX files on a movie, which is the DPX or now ACES files are what they use to create movies. Mm-hmm. If you've ever sat in a timing theater or something and watched that at 30 feet wide, it's really hard to go back even to Blu-ray media.
Blu-ray to shame. Holy smokes.
Oh, well, bear in mind, this is before they've done anything to it. This is the stuff they archive.
Right. And the data rate to play that is in the hundreds of gigabits per second, right?
Mm-hmm. If, when you're talking 4K images playing at 24 frames a second, you know, if you're looking at a single 4K 2D frame is in the order of 60, 65 megabytes.
Uh-huh. One frame.
That out. Yeah, one frame. And you're looking at playing that out at 24 frames a second, and a two-hour movie is about 170,000 frames.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your listeners can do the math and just realize what kind of hard drive they'd need.
Right. Very big and very fast.
Yeah. Now talk collection of movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, were you at NAB this year?
Yes.
Did you see the Red Cinema 4K projector with 4K content, with a 4K actual player associated with it? Did you see that demo?
I saw that demo. You're talking about the laser-based one.
Laser-based projector.
I also, the Cinema Technology Summit, Sony did a similar demo the day before NAB.
Because that seemed to me to be... Now, that I think you could either distribute 4K online, download it into this player, essentially, a hard disk-based player, or... They said you could even deliver movies on a thumb drive, essentially, you know, some sort of memory card, stick it in this thing and copy it over to the hard disk and it would play on that projector. So that seemed to me to be kind of an interesting idea. It's still physical media, potentially, but right. It could also be online delivery and it would be a download rather than a stream. And that's a distinction I think should be made when talking about online delivery, because streaming, of course, can be interrupted by any number of things. Whereas if you download it, then it's local and it will play reliably.
Well, and in the world of digital cinema, they call that store and forward.
Hmm.
Because you never watch a movie that's streaming at a cinema unless it's one of those, what they call the alternative content events.
Right, which, like a live concert or an opera or something.
Which is significantly lower data rates and significantly lower spatial resolutions, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the stuff you see when it's a movie, when you're looking at, you know, The Dark Knight Rises, that is data that was shipped to that cinema either on a hard drive or by satellite and was stored on that server before they ever tried to play it.
Right, right. And it's there locally and they don't have to worry about streaming. It's just going to play to the projector, no problem.
Right.
Yeah. One last question before we go. And that has to do with THX certification or optimization. Obviously, we've talked on the show, you and I, before, and I have with other THX people that, you know, the goal of THX is to optimize the viewer and listener experience and to recreate the producer's, the content creator's intent as closely as possible. And certainly you have THX-certified displays and THX-certified discs, Blu-rays, and so on. What can be done with online distribution in this regard? Can THX certify streams?
Well, in point of fact, we could. But, you know, Barry, you know, to your point, THX-certified means it means a number of things. Of course, it's always, we're always looking for... the devices or the media that meet the industry specifications and standards. Boy, the testing is pretty rigorous, especially for displays. In a 3D world, you actually, if you were to watch us do a test for a 3D display, you'd actually see us do more than 1,000 separate tests.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot. So we're pretty thorough in our testing, and same goes for when we're certifying Blu-ray content, be it 2D or 3D. Could that same set of techniques be applied to online? Yes, absolutely, because the expectation is online streaming media, still by the time it's delivered to your eye and ears, meets the requirements of Rec. 709 color, 2.2 or 2.4 gamma, grayscale tracking, all of the things we look for and we test, all of the artifact testing we do for compressed media. Certainly, the online media could certainly be tested for that. You have to make assumptions on available bandwidth, obviously.
Right, which is not going to be consistent from one consumer to the other.
That's true, just like a Blu-ray player wouldn't necessarily be, you know, the different brands and models of Blu-ray players aren't necessarily consistent. So for us to certify the media, you can't certify a piece of media to play on every level of quality player or screen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as an example, if we're testing 3D content, if our folks are viewing that, and they're watching it, and they actually do watch it on different levels of performance of screens. But if you, say, go to, you know, a really inexpensive screen that's prone to ghosting, you're going to see ghosting that you didn't see on that content, say, on a THX-certified plasma display.
Right.
Right? So there's things in there you just can't control. It's sort of like, if we certify a display and we say it's got, you know, you see all the details in the blacks, we measured it, we know it's there, but a consumer buys that display and puts it in a room with 400 or 500 white lamps burning, we don't expect them to have the same experience we did.
Right.
Right?
Right. And you can't predict or control that.
Absolutely. So we can emulate a given environment that is presupposed to be the way one would expect people to want to watch a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then we do our testing both on devices as well as content in that sort of context.
Right. Right. One last question regarding THX Optimizer. I know that it was placed on some TiVo boxes, and I was really encouraged by that, because whereas you can optimize a TV for a Blu-ray player by playing a disc, for example, THX Optimizer content on THX certified discs or many other test discs. But optimizing the TV for broadcast, over the air, satellite, cable, and now online is more difficult to do. What's going on with that and THX?
Well, it is more difficult to do. But again, there are one believes that in our industry there are certain absolutes. So mm-hmm. If your system Well, and you've seen the optimizer on the TiVo device,
yep.
Of course, you're optimizing for that device's ability to play back to your display.
Correct.
And what you're actually optimizing is the display's ability to manage gamut, color, tint, grayscale, not be clipping, things mm-hmm. like that. So what you're doing is the content that is prepared for broadcast is prepared in a controlled lighting environment on a calibrated display, to Rec. 709 color gamut, to a given gamma, all of those things. If then when it's sent out through broadcast and some satellite delivery or some cable delivery decides to compress the living daylights out of it to save bandwidth, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. we can't control that.
Mm.
We can only control that if you presuppose that that content was created in a certain way.
Right.
And it's going to be played back to a device that can show that to you in a certain way. Then we've matched it. We've given them the experience that the content creator expected. At that point, they've got to use a Blu-ray player or get a every system that doesn't skimp. Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of things that we just. I'd love to save the world, but I'd love to THX. On the other hand, if we THX certified everything, it wouldn't be distinctive anymore.
Well, I suppose that's true.
Yeah. So as I said offline, bearing in mind that there's a lot of displays out there to be purchased, many, many, many of them give a really good, satisfying experience. But today, we only certify about 8% of all of the available models available.
Really? Only 8%? Yeah.
And that isn't because we don't want to certify more. Mm-hmm. It's because it becomes a price performance thing for the manufacturers, and very well enough. If I'm buying a small 37-inch unit and I'm going to hang it in my kitchen where the lighting environment isn't controlled, is it as important to me that that thing is absolutely dead accurate as it is in my main viewing space? Probably not.
Sure.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. We've come to the end of a fascinating hour. I want to thank you for being here again, your second appearance on the show, and I hope the second of many more.
Well, it was a pleasure, and we'll be more than happy to talk to you again.
Excellent. Excellent. Kevin Wines, the Imaging Technology Director at THX. You can read all about what THX does with video and audio, for that matter, at THX.com. My online home, of course, is hometheater.com, and you can email me at scott@twit.tv. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Gene Dolgoff, a very popular return guest to the show, who was the inventor of LCD projector technology and is now working heavily in 3D. And in fact, he has a project he'd like your help on. So please be sure to tune in for that and learn about how you can help move the whole 3D TV technology forward. Until then, geek out.